Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here at Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer. Ken couldn't make it this week, but joining me is first-time guest and designer for eRepublic Labs, Ian Compton.
Hey there.
Hi, Ian. It's nice to meet you.
It's nice to be here. I'm glad you invited me.
Yeah. So, to begin with, since this is your first time on the cast, could you talk a little bit about who you are and what type of games you are making and the ones you like to play?
Sure. Well, my name's Ian Compton. I've been around games industry for a while now. I started off working for a British company called Games Workshop as a game developer back in the late 90s. I worked on a bunch of their tabletop miniatures games and also the board games they produce. Mm-hmm. Did that for about 5 years, working on the games and the monthly magazine White Dwarf. Then I went to work in Paris to work on the publishing side of things. So I was operations manager for the English Dark Age of Camelot servers in Europe. Mm-hmm. And also I was the lead community manager for Warhammer Age of Reckoning in Europe again.
Okay.
Did that until about 2007. Then I moved to Germany, where I started working for a company called Akoni on a free-to-play first-person shooter, which was published by Sony for about nearly a year before it was dropped. The game is called Bullet Run. We thought it was a pretty fun game, but unfortunately the market said otherwise. So that was it died a horrible death about actually almost exactly a year ago today. Sony dropped it from the lineup, and I moved to Spain shortly afterwards, where I'm working for my current employer, eRepublic, making turn-based strategy games for the iPad.
Cool. Now, you said that you worked at Games Workshop for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where your love of turn-based strategy games came from, or did you enjoy them before you got that job?
Oh, I enjoyed them well before that job. I mean, I came up, my gaming history came through tabletop pen and paper role play and through the gnarly old Avalon Hill hex-based war games, where you had, you know, a thick rule book which described the special rules for every tile on the map and crazy rules for all the different units and so forth. So I played stuff like, you know, Sixth Fleet and St. Lo and Third Reich and so forth, these gnarly old war games with stacks of cardboard counters and so forth. I also played, obviously, the classic fantasy board games that everyone's played, things like Warhammer Quest and Space Hulk and Blood Bowl and so forth.
Now, before the cast, you mentioned that you're a fan of the Dawn of War series.
I am, which is a huge fan.
The last one I played was a little bit of Dawn of War 2. I think that was the last one that was made by Relic.
Yes, right, yeah.
Now, the Warhammer series has been interesting. They've done the tabletop. I've seen Space Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said before the cast, I'm not expertise in board games and tabletop strategy games. So what makes the Warhammer game so interesting to play in the board game experience?
So I think one of the interesting things is, I mean, obviously there's a huge fan base for the IP, for both the fantasy and the science fiction settings. If you make a branded game around the Games Workshop, any of the Games Workshop IPs, you automatically get a lot of attention from millions of fans worldwide. And it's often the case that relatively ordinary games can become massive fan favorites because they use this familiar IP that is known and loved around the world. As far as what makes it compelling for turn-based games, I mean, obviously the games that the Games Workshop produce themselves, the boxed games, the board games, etc., are turn-based. Everything from the strategy games and the tabletop miniatures games, the little toy plastic soldiers and so forth, all the way to the single box products like Warhammer Quest, Space Hulk, etc. These are all turn-based games. So obviously that lends itself very easily to a direct port. And a lot of the games that have been produced using the Games Workshop IP have been direct ports of classic Games Workshop board games. Space Hulk, Warhammer Quest is on the iPad. Blood Bowl is a PC game. I just finished playing that literally just before this podcast came up. And it seems to be that when companies, it's a good way to revive older games that aren't supported by Games Workshop themselves anymore, but still have a very loyal following. I mean, the Blood Bowl community is huge, for example, and I'm willing to bet that most of the people who are playing the PC game have never even touched any of the miniatures. Obviously, THQ, Relic, with Dawn of War, they went a slightly different direction because they didn't do a direct port of the miniatures game. They did much more of a sort of Command and Conquer style or real-time strategy feeling with Dawn of War series, and they also played they didn't feel constrained by the rule set of the tabletop game. They did a computer game based on the tabletop game, which is, in my opinion, is a much braver step. and gives you a far more different experience to playing the tabletop game. It's not just a port.
Yep, and that's interesting because my first real experience to the Warhammer universe was Space Hulk for this was for 3DO at the time.
Yeah, I had that game for 3DO. My old manager had a 3DO. He used to play that all the time. Vengeance of the Blood Angels.
Yeah,
I had that game.
Yeah, I enjoy that one too. It was a very interesting mix of a real time game mm-hmm. with like that squad based or almost pausable strategy. What's interesting was at the time I had no idea what the hell Warhammer was. I didn't know this was a board game or that it basically a lot of the mechanics from the game stem from the board game like design. Mm-hmm. And when Space Hulk was announced for the PC, I think it was last year, that one has its mechanics more in line with the board game as opposed to the real time of the original. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a direct port of the last edition of the board game. There's a version of the board game that came out, collector's edition came out about 3 years ago, I think, 2-3 years ago. It was a limited edition box set. Used the same rules as the previous edition, but it was with much nicer miniatures and cardstock templates and so forth. But so the PC game that came out last year was a faithful port of the board game mechanics. There's nothing. The developers are actually adding new things to the game now, but when it was released, it was exactly the same as the board game, exactly the same rules, exactly the same experience. Whereas the 3DO one that you were talking about earlier, again, although they used the board game as a framework, they also added in a bunch of new stuff. I don't know if you recall, but they had this command time mechanic, where you had a limited amount of time where you could pause the action and give your squad specific orders. And the more successful you were, the more command time you had to slow the action down and call a timeout and catch your breath between waves of gene stealers. Whereas the 3D, the new PC version is exactly the same as board game. It's I go, you go, I go, you go. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed with the last PC version, actually. There were a lot of issues with it that I thought were fatal, which is a shame because I'm a big fan, obviously, of anything with the Games Workshop IP bolted to it. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to like it, but I couldn't bring myself to in the end.
Okay. Now, here's a question for you, both as a fan of the tabletop experience and making these turn-based strategy games. Obviously, one of the older rules or one of the suggestions a lot of designers say is to paper prototype or to basically build your game as a board game or understand how the mechanics will work in that type of setting before going to the digital or the quote-unquote real version. As a designer, are there any like difficulties or similarities between designing your game as a paper prototype or a board game experience first and then translating it? Or are they just too completely different to really compare?
So I guess the answer to that is a little bit of both. It's not really a definitive answer either way. It can be useful to prototype specific mechanics mm-hmm. And just theory craft them out. You don't even have to play them with other players. You can just make little counters and go, okay, well, in this situation, how would this work out? And just do the math on a piece of paper and mm-hmm. figure out how your mechanic works and whether it's fun or not. One of the things I think that does come that I do get from board game design mm-hmm. is as far as designing games is concerned, it doesn't matter whether it's a turn-based game or a real-time game, is a design principle I call the magic principle. Mm-hmm. And it's called the magic principle because it's based on Magic the Gathering, the card game. And it's not so much the mechanics of Magic the Gathering, it's more the constraints, the unique constraints mm-hmm. that Magic the Gathering designers have, which is that the cards are a fixed size and the font on the cards can't be too big, can't be too small, otherwise no one can read it. Mm-hmm. So they're constrained by having rules which are very very condensed, very concise. Mm-hmm. If it's more than about three lines of text, then the card's worthless. Mm-hmm. So this is a philosophy I try and bring to my designs, that if you can't explain a rule in three sentences, then it's a bad rule and you should start again.
Now, another question I have for you, this is another one that comes from my lack of knowledge on board game in general. Mm-hmm. Has board games or the general design of them, have they evolved or changed over the years like dramatically? Or are the older board games, due to the limitations of the medium, have they remained mostly the same in terms of their design or how you play them as time has gone on?
Oh, they've evolved massively. I mean,
Okay.
along with everything else, as you'd expect, they there's a huge difference. I mean, if you remember the games that we were playing when we were kids, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but you sound roughly the same generation that I'm from. The games we played as kids, we played things like Risk. We played. I'm not talking about the really really complex games. I'm talking about the games that you could buy at any toy store or any game store around. So, Axis and Allies, Risk, Escape from Colditz, Settlers of Catan, and so forth. These are fun games, and they're still fun games today. I don't want to say that these have been superseded or anything, but these were relatively straightforward games, very relatively simple rules, designed to be played in a short setting of 2 hours or so. Not discarding standard family games like Monopoly and Scrabble and so forth. And if you go into a dedicated game store these days and you look at their board game section, you'll find, especially in the Eurogame section, you'll find all these wonderful games with very, very advanced, very complex mechanics. And there's been quite a lot of innovation in the way that that games are presented as well. And in a lot of cases, I mean, we now have concepts such as the secret enemy board game, like in Fantasy Flight's Battlestar Galactica game, where it's a cooperative game, but one of the players is secretly, or one or more of the players can secretly be a traitor. You have purely cooperative games such as Arkham Asylum, which is an interesting concept because either everybody wins or nobody does. You have all these, and the Germans are leading the charge on this one. You see a lot of new games coming out of Germany, the German designers, German publishers such as Ravensburger and so forth, where they're producing these games, which are, I won't say they're super complicated, but they're certainly closer to the kind of strategy games you find on PC. If you start scouring the indie section of the Steam library, for example, you'll find all these strategy games and 4X building games and so forth. And there's a lot of board games now which are mimicking those mechanics and giving you the same experience with little wooden counters rather than pixels.
Cool. All right, taking us back to the turn-based strategy genre, it's been interesting seeing that genre evolve over the years as well. We've seen the Total War games, we've seen the grand strategy games from Paradox, and we've even seen the very niche war game scene, stuff like Strategy First. My mind is blank on some of those games. Have you played or have any knowledge on like those very extreme examples, like the war games and stuff like that?
So I've been playing a lot of turn-based strategy games recently as a way of keeping up with the trends, and obviously because I'm making a turn-based strategy game, so it's good to be aware of what other people are doing. And specifically, I've been playing a lot of turn-based strategy games on the iPad because that's obviously the market that my game is being positioned into. I've been playing a lot, and it's interesting to me to see that a lot of them could very easily be pen and paper games, could very easily be cardboard games with counters and hex maps and so forth. I've been playing one in particular called Musket Smoke, which is actually kind of a fun game. And there's no reason why that couldn't be put in a box and sold for $20 on a shelf. It's the mechanics, the movement, the experience is exactly the same as playing a board game on the iPad. Same thing with a lot of the other strategy games that you mentioned. In some cases, these could very easily be moved to a miniatures game, such as I mean, if you I don't know if you played many miniatures tabletop games, such as Flames of War, Warhammer, or whatever. You'll find that these mechanics and these experiences are almost exactly the same, with the way they handle movement and combat and dynamics of combat.
Now, as someone who has worked on both the PC strategy titles, and you're now working with the iPad, are there any major differences in like rule complexity or mechanics that you have to make adjustments to between working on the PC and now working on the iPad?
The main thing comes with multiplayer. I mean, the game I'm making at the moment is a multiplayer game, but it's asynchronous multiplayer. So you're not playing against a live opponent as such. You're playing against the opponent, but he's offline or she's offline. The big problem that comes with playing on a mobile device, specifically an iPad, not so much mobile phones, but specifically an iPad, is you can't assume the player is online. You have to, you can't assume the player is able to transmit unlimited amounts of data. With the PC, when we were making the first-person shooter game in Germany, we could assume that the player was obviously on his PC, had a broadband connection, with able to transmit as much data as we needed to transmit between the server and the client. With the iPad, you can't guarantee that. You can say the player's online, but you can't send as much data as you like because a lot of times players people are paying for that data, sometimes at quite a steep markup. So one of the big one of the big sacrifices you have to make is you have to give up the opportunity to check things dynamically, and instead have the player trust the client more than you feel comfortable with as a designer.
Are there like any other considerations, like in terms of like mechanics or rules that may not fit with the iPad design?
Not so much. I mean, the main thing really is the control surfaces. I mean, with a PC, you have obviously a keyboard and a mouse. You have quite a lot of complexity, quite a lot of different interactions with the way that the player can interact with the game. You can have hotkeys, you can have mouse gestures, you can have obviously very tiny buttons that it would be impossible to click on a touchscreen, but are fine to click with a mouse. With the touchscreen, there are gestures you can use which make things easier, but you need to be able to communicate how those gestures work to the player, which means either overhead in terms of some kind of tutorial, or you have to assume that they're common enough that the player will just automatically understand them, like, you know, pinch and stretch to zoom in and zoom out and stuff like that. And your UI has to be very, very clear. You can't have any clutter in there at all. It has to be as minimal and as open as possible, because otherwise players will never be able to actually use it.
Yeah, especially if it is an entirely touchable interface, if everything's too close together, what's going to happen. People are going to hit like two or three buttons, or their hands going to slip, and who knows what will happen.
Sure.
Now, from your experience making the games for the iPad, has the turn-based genre flourished on the iPad? Because we've seen some cases where, on the PC at least, that there hasn't been as many turn-based strategy games or even real-time strategy games that have been released in the last few years.
I think there have been quite a few released. I mean, both the PC and for the iPad. I think that mostly though they've been from smaller publishers, or they've been greenlit on Steam or through indie channels like that, rather than coming from the big developers and the big publishers. Mm-hmm. For the iPad, I mean, the iPad's a very good platform for turn-based strategy games. I mean, it's essentially a content consumption device, so people use it purely for gaming, just purely for playing games. Rather than for, the main PC might be shared for a lot of different things. It might be shared, for work. It might be shared for media streaming, whatever. Whereas the iPad is purely for consuming content. So when you have a platform, and the iPad as well has the advantage that nearly everybody who has an iPad has access to the App Store. Mm-hmm. So you can, there's a lot of different channels you can make people aware of games in there. So I think it's very much the case that the iPad is a platform perfectly suited for gaming. And because it's because of the format it has, and because of the limitations on the UI and so forth, it makes it extremely well suited for turn-based gaming. And you see a lot of this stuff. I mean, you see there's a particularly good game I've been playing a lot of recently called Hunters 2 by Rodeo Games, mm-hmm. which is a turn-based strategy game. It's a science fiction game. These are very high quality games. These are exactly the same quality you'd find in a decent PC game.
Okay. Now, speaking about releasing games on the App Store, one of the things that a lot of PC focused developers and fans like myself have been hearing about is the problem with pricing games on the App Store. Because there are just so many games on there, we keep hearing cases of people having trouble basically pricing their games. So do people make games for like 99 cents or even cheaper? Sure. As someone who's designing strategy games for the iPad, and a strategy game is normally a game that is usually priced a little bit higher due to all the work that's involved and just the development that gets into them, have you noticed any issues or any type of differing philosophy when it comes to pricing these types of games on the iPad
sure.
market?
Well, we fix that problem by making our game free.
Okay.
So this is, I mean, for the iPad, for mobile gaming, free is a very good price point. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a good price point for the player, obviously, but it's a good price point for the developer. If you have any level of online multiplayer or even online single player, free is free with microtransactions or some freemium mechanics is an excellent model. There's very little reason, in my opinion, to charge money for the client unless you're presenting it purely as a single player offline experience.
Okay.
If the player needs to connect to the server for any reason, then in my opinion, it should be a free game, and you should find ways to monetize the game experience. Having said that, though, there are many games which are which aren't free. The game I mentioned a few minutes ago, Hunters 2, isn't a free game, for example. Neither were games such as Infinity Blade, or the XCOM game was released to the iPad as a premium product. I believe it was €20 when it was released in the App Store a few months ago. So there is clearly a space for games which are offered at all kinds of price points. XCOM was kind of a bent the curve a little bit, because it was a €20 app is an expensive app for the iPad. But obviously, given the fact that it was almost the exact port of the AAA PC product, clearly Firaxis felt that they could 2K felt they could justify that price for the experience they're offering.
Now, I haven't followed too much the iPad version of XCOM. Has it been doing well on the App Store or on mobile devices?
It did well. I mean, obviously the name and the marketing budget that 2K had helped it a lot. I've played it on both PC and the iPad, and the experience is very, very similar, with the only real difference being the interface for the touchscreen. I would say it's been a success. It certainly gathered a lot of attention. The main thing with the iPad is that the App Store is a very, very, very competitive environment.
Yeah.
And even very big games, such as XCOM or whatever, they'll be on the front page featured for literally a few days before they're pushed off by new releases, because there's new games coming all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes these are good games, sometimes they're not, but it doesn't matter. They're coming out anyway, and they're pushing your product further and further down the list.
Now, I want to go back to what you were talking about a few minutes ago regarding monetization and freemium, because this is one of the more controversial or highly debated topics among gamers. We've seen people who basically swear off any DLC, any microtransactions. They call them, bane of the industry. They're going to ruin it. Then there are people who enjoy them, or the games that have found a way to basically balance the free-to-play with the monetization. So stuff like League of Legends, Card Hunter, or even something like Team Fortress 2.
Yeah, World of Tanks, etc., yeah.
Yeah. Now, for you and the games that you're working on at eRepublic, what's your design philosophy when it comes to the monetization of your games?
Okay, so my opinion, this is just me talking as a designer rather than me talking as a spokesman for eRepublic or anything. I would say that there's two kinds of players who are very important for a free-to-play game. You need to take care of both of these groups of players as much as you can. So the first group of players that's very important are the players who are paying for your game. Because obviously these are the people who are making sure you don't have to eat noodles every month and keeping the lights on. And you need to keep those happy, because otherwise they'll stop paying for your game, and then everyone has to go home and get real jobs. The second group of players you need to keep happy are the people who aren't paying for your game, because these people are providing content, especially in a multiplayer game.
Yeah.
If the only people in your game are the people who are paying, then unless you're super, super lucky, you've managed to convert 100% of your players to paying players, you'll find that you won't have enough content in your game to keep people for very long. So you need to service both of these groups of players in different ways and make sure that they're both engaged and both find reasons to keep coming back to your game equally. And obviously the things that interest them are going to be different, so you need to make sure that both of the aspects that will retain these players are both these groups of players are present in the game.
Yeah, now, my recent experience with monetization and freemium play would probably be the game Marvel Puzzle Quest, which I got hooked on maybe about a month ago. And from what I've been reading, this was a game that was originally designed for the mobile devices that was then ported or brought over to the PC, specifically Steam. And one of the things that I noticed was that it's one of those games that is very much a monetized experience. It's a game that really is designed more for the people who pay for the game as opposed to those who just want to play for free.
Sure.
Now, when it comes to your games and specifically trying to make a turn-based strategy game for the free audience, how do you balance between making content for the paying customers without it basically stepping on the toes of those who won't pay for it or who can't pay for it?
Okay, so the first thing you do really is you make all the features available to everybody, and that doesn't mean that everything is available for free. Some things might only be available for the real money currency in the game. Obviously, these games, what you generally do is you pay money to have some kind of hard currency. In our case, it's gems.
Yeah.
So you pay $5 to have a bag of gems, and you spend these gems on things in the shop. So it might be that some things in the game are only available for gems. But you make sure that everyone has access to that, and you give people free money. You give people free currency. You say, look, here are some gems. Play with these gems. And you make it so that players can have the things that free players can have the things that paying players can have, but they either need to wait longer to have them, or they need to play more often to have them, or they need to achieve more in the game to have those things. So the people who are playing, who are paying, they don't have access to new abilities or more powerful options or whatever, but what they do have is they have those things more often.
Okay. So does your game have a free currency or an in-game currency that is earned next to the premium currency or the one that you have to pay for?
Sure. I mean, so our game actually has three currencies. Okay. We have two in-game currencies, which you generate through harvesting. Mm-hmm. And also you can get them from attacking other players. You can capture them from other players. Mm-hmm. And this will, this is what you use to upgrade your base, upgrade your soldiers, generally do the, for most in-game purchases, most in-game items, you use these two free currencies that you generate, you gather, you either harvest or capture. Mm-hmm. The hard currency, the real money currency, is used for either purchasing. If you're short of the in-game currency, if you need to have more of it to perform an upgrade and you don't have it yet, you can spend the real money to cut out that weight. Or you can use it to speed things up. So if you have a timer, if you're upgrading something, it's going to take you, I don't know, 20 minutes. You can say, okay, I don't want to wait 20 minutes. I want to have it now. You click a button and spend some gems, and now you have it immediately rather than having to wait for it. So our hard currency is mostly as a frustration blocker.
Okay.
To cut out waiting times, and also to act as sort of instant gratification rather than having to wait to earn things.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood you earlier. You said that players can earn the premium currency through play.
Yes. Okay. So we give it away through various mechanics in the game. Obviously not in huge quantities, but enough that after playing for a little while, you'll have enough to make some purchases in the store and have access to the same stuff that paying players have.
And
a lot of games do this as well. You'll find this is quite a common thing if you play even things like browser games. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of thing.
Now, in terms of purchases, do you have any cosmetic or aesthetic purchases that can only be afforded through premium currency?
We don't currently. So, to be clear, our game's not released yet. Okay. We're releasing it later this year. We're in a friends and family beta at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're going to be releasing it. Soft launch is scheduled for the end of February, beginning of March time, roughly, sort of beginning of spring. And then the full global launch will be coming out a few weeks to a month or so after that.
Okay.
So currently we're developing it as our feature set is quite tight at the moment. We purely have the things that are specifically mechanics based and core mechanics based at that. And then we have a plan for following the launch to add in a whole bunch of extra stuff. And it might well be that cosmetic items are part of that lineup.
Now, in your opinion, when it comes to these premium currencies and trying to make both the free players and the paying players happy, what do you consider like the best case scenario, or like what or how the game is designed that it can appeal to both groups of audiences without annoying either one?
Sure. So the best case scenario is a situation which I call the illusion of choice, where free-to-play players don't believe that they have to pay to advance, where they don't run into a wall where they can get this far and no further unless they pay money. Mm-hmm. Or if they get to a point where they feel the game is holding them back because they haven't spent any money. Mm-hmm. So if they never see that, then they'll always believe that they have a choice as to whether they spend money or not. Obviously, as a game designer, developer, you want people to spend money in your game. So you want to put in things which will encourage them to spend money, or put in things which will, which will act as slowdown mechanics to encourage them to reach for their wallet and buy things. But as long as players believe that when they buy it, it's their choice rather than the game forcing them to do it, then they'll be much more amenable to make that choice in the first place. If players come up against a hard wall and the game basically says to them, if you want to go any further than this, you need to pay money, then obviously that's a decision point for other players, and a lot of them will just leave the game at that point because they'll see that they're basically being held up and they either have to pay or not. Whereas if they believe it's their decision to do so, and they've come to realize the value of spending money, and they're engaged enough in the game that they feel that it's the choice they want to make rather than the choice the game is forcing them to make, then they'll be much more amenable to that. And in some cases, these can be the same mechanics. They don't have to be a different set of mechanics. It's just the way they're presented to the player and the way the player perceives how they're encountering them.
Okay. Now, you mentioned about having the timer or the way to speed up that player weight side. And this is one of the things that, as a PC gamer, I know a lot of PC fans as well, aren't real fans of player weight mechanics. So, as a designer, how do you, design these to make them impactful enough that, you know, the options there to spend money, they're going to spend it, but not so much in your face that, as you said, it's not like that brick wall that's going to pop up saying you need to spend $2 or you're going to have to wait 2 days or 24 hours to play again or something like that.
Sure. So our game is, we have a matchmaking system in our game which puts you against players of roughly equivalent power. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. So from the player's point of view, if you're playing our game and you decide you want to launch an attack on somebody, mm-hmm. you click the attack button and it sends you up against a base that's roughly the same power level as yours, mm-hmm. Same level of defenses as your attackers. It doesn't matter to you as a player. The player experience is the same whether that opponent has spent 6 months building up his base without paying us a cent, or whether he just joined yesterday and has dropped $50 on the game and has built up. He's got to that point faster. But for you as a player, the experience is the same, regardless of whether he's a free-to-play player or a paying player, as his opponent. So in that case, paying the money gives an advantage in game, but it doesn't mean that you're going to lose because he spent money and you didn't.
Essentially, it's what Val talked about a few years ago in terms of how there has to be some kind of weight to the mechanics, either a time weight, as in more you play, more in-game experience you build up, or a monetary value, or the more money you spend, and how the two basically different people perceive their values differently, I guess.
Yes, exactly. That's the thing. So some players value money more and some players value time more. So for those who have time but no money, they can play, time but don't wish to pay money for whatever reason, they can play the game for free and they'll advance more slowly, but they'll get to the same point eventually. And for those who who don't want to play as much or don't have time to play as much, but aren't averse to opening their wallets and giving some money to a free-to-play game, then they'll have the opposite options.
Okay. One last question regarding the monetization and free-to-play, and then we'll move on to our next subject.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now, earlier I talked about a few of the games that I consider to be good examples of that free-to-play balance between pay and play. As a mobile designer and someone who has studied these games a lot more than I have, are there any good examples that you can think of off the top of your head that are either A, really good examples of that balance, or B, games that have failed to provide that balance between free and pay design?
Sure. So I've been playing a lot of strategy games and free to play games generally. I mean, not just strategy games, but also browser games. I've been playing things like The Settlers Online, which is a browser game by Blue Byte. I played a few until it closed down last year. I played Command and Conquer Alliances as well, Tiberium Alliances, which was a browser game from EA Phenomic. And I've been playing a bunch of the free-to-play games on the iPad, such as Clash of Clans, Boom Beach, and Game of War by MZ. And most of those games have a good balance, in my opinion, especially the browser games. Settlers Online, I think, is a particularly good example of a game that has that balance exactly right. I know a lot of people in the game who have never spent a penny on the game, but they're still enjoying it, they're still at a high level, they're very, very engaged in the game. And the chances are, eventually, most of those players, I expect, probably will end up spending some money. Mm-hmm. Which obviously with the publisher is a great thing. For the opposite example I would give would be Game of War by Machine Zone, Californian company, and it's a fairly hardcore strategy game with very abstractive mechanics, but this does have very specific walls in the game. There are points where you cannot advance unless you spend money. You literally cannot advance unless you spend money. There's no way to advance without buying things for real money in the game. And to me, that's, although the game is doing extremely well, they're making an awful lot of money on the game. If you look at the App Store statistics, they're making crazy amounts of money on this game. To me, I feel that it kind of goes against my instincts as a designer to put in these hard breaks where players have to either quit the game or pay money.
Okay. Yeah, and that's where I'm at as well. Whenever a game just says, you know, you must stop unless you give us $2 or $3 or whatever, I'm like, why should I do that? Because what's to stop them from, you know, pulling the same stunt again, you know, an hour or two later into the game?
Sure.
Now, one question that I just thought of when you were bringing up the Settlers Online is the fact that the free-to-play genre has become big both among the mobile side as well as the PC side, either in terms of a standalone release or a browser-based game.
Sure.
As someone who's been playing and experimenting and analyzing both sides, do you notice like any like difference in feel or even like a difference in like your psychological attitude towards a free-to-play game if it's on the iPad or mobile device versus the PC release?
No, not really. I mean, it used to be the case, and it's the same on both platforms. It used to be the case that free-to-play games were free because no one would ever pay for them. They were generally low-quality games that were offered free to try and pull players and give them as low a possible barrier to entry in the hope that enough of the people who started it would carry on playing and would then spend money. But obviously in recent years, in the last 4 or 5 years even, you've had some extremely high quality free-to-play games come out which have blown that model out of the water. You have things like, you know, League of Legends earlier, World of Tanks, Team Fortress 2. And then on the mobile side of things, you have things like Clash of Clans and so forth. And no one would ever consider those games to be poor quality games, as far as the production values and the mechanics are concerned.
All right, so I think with that, let's move on. Normally on the cast, we like to talk about the news of the week, but we are recording on a Sunday, and there really hasn't been any news yet, so we're just going to skip that. And Ian, since you're new for the cast, I want to talk a little bit about Kickstarter and crowdfunding, because I think that's a very interesting topic, and it's one that everyone has their own thoughts and opinions on. So with Kickstarter, one thing that I want to ask you is, as you've looked at the platform, have you been looking mainly at like the video game projects or any of like the board games that have really been funded and popular on the crowdfunding platform?
Well, I'm a big fan of, still a big fan of tabletop wargaming. So you're probably aware there's been an awful lot of very, very successful wargaming projects on Kickstarter. Mantic Games in the UK, who actually founded and mostly started by former Games Workshop staff, they've had a lot of, they have a great deal of success with things like Dreadball and their other games on Kickstarter. Also, various American miniatures companies have produced huge Kickstarter packs of thousands and thousands of miniatures, and they've blown their stretch goals out of the water and made crazy amounts of money for that sort of So I mean, for miniatures games and for board games, it's a wonderful thing. A lot of the, when you're talking about physical product like board games or miniatures games, obviously a lot of the, you need to have a lot of upfront capital to be able to produce the physical goods, you know, the actual boards, have them either molded in China or printed and shipped or whatever and sent out. And for somebody who's who doesn't have that capital, if you're an aspiring designer with a good idea and a great concept, if you coming up with that capital is obviously a kind of a tricky thing if you don't have a publisher or somebody behind you, and Kickstarter gives those people the opportunity to make those things happen. And we've seen some absolutely wonderful games come through on Kickstarter. I mean, as I say, Dreadball by Mantic, Cards Against Humanity is probably a great example there of board games coming through there. I think as far as PC games are concerned, I think there's a lot. The ones that tend to make the news are the ones that are very clearly destined for failure. There are a lot. It seems to be three kinds of games, video games on Kickstarter. There are the ones that are reasonable and realistic, and they're generally smaller scale games with very tightly defined scope. And you think, okay, yep, these people could probably make that game with this amount of money they're asking for, and those are the ones that I'm always rooting for. There's a particular one came out last year on Kickstarter by one of my favorite studios, Ice Pick Lodge in Russia. And they were producing a horror survival game called Knock Knock. And I was following that quite closely. That sounds exactly like the kind of project that I would back on Kickstarter. I didn't for a variety of reasons, but if I was going to back a project on Kickstarter, it would be that one. That kind of game. Then you have games which are promising the moon on a stick, and it's very clear that they're never going to, well, it's clear to me at least, that they're never going to deliver the things they're offering, the things they're promising. You see a lot of people with sort of head in the clouds design, thinking they can produce a full featured MMO for $800,000 or something.
Yeah.
Okay, there's zero chance that's going to happen. And then the third group are people who could fund it themselves, or probably could fund it themselves, but for some reason are choosing to go Kickstarter for the publicity. And you see a lot of well-known former game designers or former games industry people, such as Richard Garriott or Brad McQuaid, pushing games on Kickstarter. And you think, well, why are you asking people to drum up $1 million between them when you could make a call to, I don't know, Sony or to EA and say, hey, here's a pitch for a game, and probably get it published through more traditional channels? And it feels to me more like a marketing gimmick than an actual funding exercise.
Yep, and we've heard of cases on Kickstarter where the funding is actually not used for developing the game, but it's more as a way of showing a publisher or someone who's going to contribute to it that, hey, there's people interested in it.
I think that's a specious argument, to be honest. I don't buy that for a second. I think some people might believe that's true, but I think that if you're, especially when you see these games coming from industry veterans, such as the people I just mentioned, Brad McQuaid or Richard Garriott or Mark Jacobs, these people have networks. They have people who will listen to them if they walk into a room and say, I have an idea for a game. I think that convincing investors, if investors need to be convinced by having a 6-week Kickstarter, then there's probably better investors you could go to.
Yeah. Now, I'm going back to board games and their Kickstarters. One thing that I find very interesting is, as you said, there's a lot more cost to developing and releasing a board game as opposed to a digital game. Obviously, you have to create all these miniatures, boards, and basically physical products that have to be created, manufactured, and then shipped around the world. And
sure,
it's funny to me about how much board games Kickstarters have really thrived. I mean, everyone that I see or someone mentions on Quarter 3 or whatever, when I look up that Kickstarter, not only did it hit its goal, but it probably hit like 10 or 12 stretch goals as well.
Sure. Well, I should start, I guess, by just clarifying, I'll just being a little bit contrary there. It's not more expensive to produce a board game than it is to produce a video game. Mm-hmm. Because obviously artists, coders, etc. don't work for free. And when you're talking about the production cost of a video game, even a fairly modest video game with a staff of maybe 5 or 6 people, it's probably going to cost you at least as much, if not more, than a physical game. Mm-hmm. However, with the physical game, the costs are all in the tooling and the manufacture, generally speaking. Once you've got the rules playtested, then that's 90% of your cost is actually producing the physical goods and shipping them.
Okay.
So if you can overcome that hurdle, then the rest of it is very cheap.
So
sorry, carry on.
So I just wanted to make sure that I'm on the same page. So in that case, the difference between a video game Kickstarter and what would be considered a board game Kickstarter would be, for the video game, the money and the funding would basically be going towards the programming, the development of the game, while for the board game, because it is based on a series of rules, that funding is mainly just used for the production side. Is that right?
Or... yes, that's how that's largely how I see it. Okay. Most of the cost of the big expenses in physical game production are tooling for the game pieces, and printing up boxes and cards and rule books and so forth.
Okay.
Whereas obviously for video game production, it goes into the salaries of the various technical personnel.
Okay.
Difference between video games and board games and Kickstarter and how they, the board games are very popular, breaking their, I mean, you see things from Mantic Games and Dark Sword Miniatures where they're just absolutely blowing through their stretch goals in matters of days almost. I mean, I think if I recall, Dreadball was completely funded within 3 days or 4 days or so of launching on Kickstarter. I think that says a lot for, first of all, the wargaming community around the world who are following these games, following their favorite companies and their favorite designers around on Kickstarter. And they're organizing on forums such as Board Game Geek or Broken Forum or F13 or whatever, and they're talking about the new Kickstarters coming out, and the word gets around. I think that's a great thing for the traditional games market, that they're able to leverage this online presence and have this sort of fanatical base of fans who are all extremely invested in the products that they're buying.
All right, now Before I ask you some of the questions that I like to ask new guests about Kickstarter, I know earlier you mentioned you had some reservations about crowdfunding and Kickstarter in general. So before I get to those questions, what are those and that you would like to talk about?
Well, we already touched them a little bit when we're talking about the different kinds of Kickstarter projects and how you have some which are which appear to be developed more as a marketing exercise than as a genuine crowdfunding process. It seems to me in a lot of cases that the Kickstarter is basically nothing more than a pay to market my game for me rather than a pay to produce my game for me.
Okay.
And a lot of cases, it seems that I think the way it's presented, a lot of the projects, the way they're presented, originally when Kickstarter was launched, the idea was it would be for people to invest in ideas. So they would, someone would have an idea and people would invest in that idea, and whether or not there may or may not be a payoff in the future from that. It might be a physical product being produced, or there might not be a physical product being produced, or there might, but now it seems that Kickstarter, in a lot of cases, is almost a pre-order mechanism as well, rather than an investment mechanism. That's obviously, part of that's inherent in the way that the rewards are set up, where, you know, if I spend $60 or $100 or whatever backing a game, then I would quite like to have a copy of that game when it's finished. But in many cases, you see physical products being put up where the only pledge level is get a copy of the thing. And to me, that's not so much kickstarting, that's pre-ordering.
Yeah, and that is an interesting point and goes into one of the questions I have for you, Ian.
Sure.
Another part that has sort of grown out of Kickstarter and crowdfunding has been the system of early access. And of course, this is Steam's program for getting games onto the platform. And we talked about this with previous guests over the last few weeks. And what crowdfunding and even early access has done has sort of reversed the funding model for video games. Normally, a video game doesn't see any real money until it's done and people are buying it and it's in stores. But with crowdfunding and early access, now you're basically buying the game or giving the developers the money while the game is either in development or hasn't even, you know, gone out of Alpha 1 yet. So,
sure.
In your opinion, Ian, what are your thoughts on crowdfunding or early access in that regard? Do you see it as a positive step for the game industry, or do you see it more as causing more problems than solutions?
So I think for the indie developer who doesn't have access to, or doesn't have easy access to, more traditional funding mechanisms. I mean, obviously the traditional funding mechanism is you find a publisher, the publisher gives you money, you develop a game, and then the publisher keeps some of the money from selling the game, and you get some of it too. Obviously, when you're talking about, as you mentioned, Steam's Greenlight project as an example, and other projects which probably wouldn't attract a traditional publisher, then obviously money has to come from somewhere. Unless people are literally coding it in their spare time and aren't expecting to be paid for it, then someone needs to pay for the software licenses, the coders, the servers, all the costs that go into making a video game. So if you don't have angel investors, you don't have a publisher, then promising early access for that seems to be a reasonable trade-off. I find it, again, I find it hard to defend when it's coming from a company that would have, or coming from a developer that would have access to more traditional funding avenues. When you see big publishers basically charging for early access, I think, again, this ties back into using the, even though it might not actually be on the Kickstarter platform, essentially it is a Kickstarted product, where they're using the crowdfunding or the early access funding as a marketing tool rather than as a integral part of the development, either by funding development or by actually producing usable feedback. Because in my experience of having run beta products, most of it is a marketing exercise rather than a feedback exercise.
Okay. And here's the other question I have for you. One of the things that we've seen over the last year or so with Kickstarter is a lot of the big games, basically bringing this system into the forefront, stuff like Broken Age, Shadowrun, have been released, and they've been met with not exactly universal praise. Some people have liked it, other people have been disappointing it. And this has led to this question on, is crowdfunding going to remain this, basically this gold mine or this viable option for developers in the years to come? And it's an interesting debate. We've had people on who've said, yes, they see it that way. Others have said no, or they've had some reservations about the viability of crowdfunding. So, Ian, in your opinion, what do you think about that? Do you think crowdfunding will remain a possible option, or do you think that it will start to die down or the bubble may burst over the years?
I don't think the bubble's like to burst or anything. I don't think there is a bubble, to be honest. I think that it's evolved to where it is now, and it's going to continue evolving, and people's expectations of it will change over time as well. But I expect it's going to be a fairly significant part of funding and marketing for projects in the foreseeable future. It's certainly when you're talking, there's a lot more ways now to get product out to players, whether it's video games or board games or books or whatever else you're making, than there ever was before. And Kickstarter gives people it's part of the democratization of content, which we're seeing with the evolution of the web, and I expect that's going to continue. I don't expect there to be a bubble that bursts or anything. As far as I think, what will evolve is that people's expectations of what to expect, what they'll get for kickstarting will change, and it will become much less abstract, much less based around investing on opportunity, and much more based on pre-ordering and having early access to product than it was previously.
Okay.
I think that's going to be the big pivotal change that you'll see in the crowdfunding model in the future.
Okay. And I just thought of one last question. Now, you sort of answered this during our talk, but I just want to basically bring up one last time. When you look at Kickstarter projects, either board game or video games, are there any like specific things that catches your eye or makes you interested in funding them, as opposed to other things that may dissuade you from funding a project?
One of the things that really interests me when I see Kickstarter projects is the amount of effort that's gone into the pitch and goes into continually engaging the people who are interested in the Kickstarter, the not just backers, but the people who are keeping up with the project. When I see projects that are constantly being updated with significant content updates, questions and answers from the teams, new things like concept art or news about development in general, I think that's the thing that engages players and that separates the good Kickstarter that's likely to succeed from the one that's not likely to succeed or interest me.
Okay, with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about some of the games that we've played, and then we'll wrap things up with talking brief about turn-based strategy design. Mm-hmm. So for me, the game that I want to talk about is the game Chibi Robo Photo Finder. Now, this is a it's pretty much one of Nintendo's more niche series. Have you heard of this before, Ian?
I haven't. I don't actually have a 3DS, but
The game, it originally started on the GameCube, and what it was essentially a casual or more simplified take on open-world gameplay. You're this little robot, and you're in this giant house, and your sole task is basically to make people happy. And it's not that challenging. It's just more about a very relaxing game. You can basically go around and clean up after the people, and that gets you currency that you can use to upgrade your little robot. And it's sort of built into this sort of Metroid-like progression where you may unlock a blaster, you may unlock like a little helicopter that will allow you to float and get over gaps. So the series, in a very weird marketing strategy, Nintendo made the second game exclusive to Walmart. So you could only buy it from Walmart for, like, I think a year or two. And then after that, we didn't hear anything else about until the game basically snuck onto the 3DS service earlier in January. And it keeps with the same basic mechanics, but my problem with the game is that it makes use of the 3DS camera, which is basically Nintendo's way of you can take pictures with it and record stuff like that. And the problem is that the game simply doesn't work because of this camera. The camera is such a low-quality camera that, A, it doesn't pick up the objects you have to take pictures of. So the idea is that you're trying to fill this museum with, like, souvenirs from our world. So they give you, like, a silhouette of an object, and then you have to find that object, you know, in your actual living space, and you take a picture of it. But the problem is that, one, the camera doesn't have a flash to it, so you have to rely on ambient light. And two, because the resolution is so poor, it doesn't pick things up that well. I had a case where it told me that I had to take a picture of a CD case. So I was holding up and I got it like perfectly in its little silhouette, and it kept giving me a 0% accuracy. And to make things worse, the entire progression model of the game is based on the use of this camera mechanic. And because it doesn't work, I basically can't get far into the game.
Right.
And to me, it's an example of the dangers of trying to use these different accessories or trying to make a game that uses a seldom often used piece of your technology. We've seen this happen with Nintendo with having to buy like these crazy peripherals. I've seen, you know, the Super Scope for the Super Nintendo, bongos at one point. And it's always that danger when you're trying to create a unique game with a unique peripheral that if it doesn't work right, or the peripheral wasn't, you know, the highest quality, your game basically can be shot in the foot before you even started.
Sure. So I think the problem with that game is that the problem the developers of that game saw is that they have no control over how good the camera is. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, for example, when Guitar Hero makes you buy a plastic instrument, a plastic guitar, yeah. they have some level of control over how responsive the pads on the guitar or the drum pads or whatever are. Mm-hmm. They can design the game yeah. around the limitations of the hardware. In this one, because the camera is integral to the portable gaming device, the developers have to take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a case where it seems to me to be a case where their ambition oversteps the limits of the hardware in this case, which isn't unique. I'm trying to think of an example where I've seen that before, and I'm coming up with things like, I mean, I think even the plastic eye, the little camera that came for the PS2 or PS3 for the Magic Eye games, the card games, Eye of Judgment, that's the one. A lot of people had problems with that for the same reasons you say, where it's the resolution wasn't particularly good, or it for some reason it wouldn't recognize images terribly well. But I think it's good that people try these different mechanics, even if they don't work the first time. Obviously, it's bad for people who bought that game and found they couldn't advance. But what will happen is that people will refine the mechanic and they'll refine the concept, and maybe in the next generation of games will get it right. But without trying it the first time. Yeah. You wouldn't get to that point.
Yeah, I think you made a good point, Ian, about how the developers were sort of forced to use the camera. It's not like they were able to design their own little camera to put on the 3DS. I think what they really should have done was they should have solved those problems and tried to make some kind of extra accommodations to it. Maybe lax the accuracy rating. Or one thing that I just find very stupid mechanic was that you only have 10 chances to take a correct picture of an object. Or if you don't, the film that you use, they say it wears out, and then you have to basically grind the activities to get more currency to buy new film. And I think that was just a poor option, because then you're basically punishing the player for things that are outside of their control.
Yes, that's definitely the case. If they're punishing the player for limitations of the software, then that's definitely a bad idea. And like you say, I'm not saying that the developers have are the victims here or anything, or they've had... it's not their fault that the game doesn't work the way you expect it to. I think that it's probably one of those things where when you're sitting in a brightly lit QA lab, mm-hmm. the camera probably works a whole lot better than it does when you're, you know, in a ambient lighting at home in sunlight or mm-hmm. or whatever.
Or if you're in my house, which is like 50 years old and the wiring is shot and my lights yes. are so poor that
sure.
it's just like impossible to take any picture of anything in here. All right. So let's move on. Ian, are there any games that you've been playing lately that you would like to talk about?
I've been playing a game on the iPad called Boom Beach, mm-hmm. which is the latest game from Supercell. Now, if you may recall, Supercell had a huge breakout hit a year and a half or so ago called Clash of Clans, which became kind of the reference mm-hmm. Building strategy game for the iPad. Mm-hmm. It was making crazy amounts of money. They produced another game in the meantime, a farming game called Heyday. But this is their next attempt at a strategy game mm-hmm. along the same ideas as Clash of Clans. And I've been very interested because Clash of Clans was such a huge hit. I mean, it made more money than everything else on the App Store for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's still making a huge amount of money even a year and a half later, mm-hmm. which in the mobile space is practically unheard of. You know, games come and go all the time. You said they push down the charts all the time.
Yeah.
Clash of Clans has literally hundreds of clones. There's loads of those games copying exactly the game, that game, with varying levels of redesign on the art assets, keeping the mechanics intact. So it would seem reasonable to expect that if Boom Beach would be a Clash of Clans 2, using the same mechanics but refined, using the metric, using the information they've learned from the metrics from Clash of Clans, from the lessons they've learned from monetization and retention data that they have. But instead, they've made some very brave, very interesting choices, which completely turn everything on its head. And it's interesting for me as a designer to see not just what they kept from Clash of Clans, but what they changed. So for those of you who have never played this game, or never played Clash of Clans on the iPad, essentially Boom Beach is a strategy game. You start with a base, you build it up, you have in-game currencies which you use to upgrade your buildings and so forth, and you attack other players to get more resources. And that's basically the core loop. You farm resources, you capture the resources from battle, and you use these resources to upgrade your base and upgrade your soldiers so you can fight more effectively and defend more effectively. It's a fairly straightforward loop, and it's as far as it goes. Clash of Clans has a very simplified version of this. You build an army, you attack with the army, and then afterwards you have to build your army again. Your army is expended. They're like potions, basically. They're consumables. In Boom Beach, your army actually isn't expended. Only the ones who die have to be replaced, so you get to use the same army again and again and again. And because it's a mobile game, because it's a free-to-play game, and they want to have a cooldown mechanic, and they have to have some way of throttling your progress in the game, both these games have very different approaches to how that works. So in Clash of Clans, as I said, you attack with an army, and when it's finished attacking, you have to build it again from the start. And this takes longer the further into the game you are, the higher level you are. So to start with, it might just be 2 or 3 minutes you have to wait before you can attack again. In later levels, you might have to wait several hours, or a couple of hours at least, before you're ready before you've built everything, you're ready to go again. Boom Beach doesn't have that, because your army is persistent. So unless things die, you don't have to replace them. It's more like, Command and Conquer, where you send your tanks out in a wave to attack, and then the ones who don't die are able to attack the next base. But the way they've throttled it is through having a limited number of opponents available to you. So you only have a defined number of opponents that you're able to attack, and the opponents you're able to attack are pre-selected. You can't choose to attack different ones. In Clash of Clans, you choose to attack somebody, it gives you a random matchmaking opponent, and if you don't like that one, you can keep hitting next until you find someone you think you can beat, and you can keep doing it as often as you like. In Boom Beach, that's not the option. You have the game says to you, here's a list of people you're allowed to attack, and if you don't want to attack these, then that's too bad. Wait until you find someone you like. So to me, that's a much more hardcore mechanic, and it's a much more it's a much harsher mechanic than the Clash of Clans version, and it's very clearly targeting a very different player type to Clash of Clans. So Boom Beach seems to be designed for people who were playing Clash of Clans or enjoying it, but wanted something a bit more engaging, a bit more interactive, and a little bit less casual. And Boom Beach is that game.
Now, I think with Clash of Clans, I think one thing that I find amazing about it is that it's one of the few mobile games I've actually seen commercials for on the TV. And the only other mobile game I can think of that reached that level of notoriety was Angry Birds by Rovio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been huge. I mean, like I said, it made crazy amounts of money. If you look at the I believe it's in some markets it's still in the top five, which is for a game that's a year and a half old, is incredible. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, it would be the PC charts don't move as fast as the mobile charts, obviously, but it would be the equivalent would be if something like Baldur's Gate 2 was still in the top three or something, you know.
And that actually brings up a question I forgot to ask you earlier, Ian, about the mobile market. Now, you just said that being around for a year and a half is an amazing feat for a mobile game. What is, like, the general lifespan for a mobile game's marketability?
To be honest, that's still something that people are discovering. And it very much depends on the kind of game as well. When you're talking about, in the same way that things like League of Legends and World of Tanks skew the graph for all the other free-to-play PC games, things like Clash of Clans, Angry Birds, and so forth, and Candy Crush skew the charts for mobile games as well. Most games aren't going to be Candy Crush or Clash of Clans. Most games are going to be much less popular than that and make much less money. So the data on those is still fairly fuzzy. There's still a lot of people learning about how that works. And it depends on the kind of game as well. I mean, very, very casual games tend to cycle very quickly. So, I mean, Clash of Clans is obviously, Candy Crush is obviously an extremely casual game. It's a match three game. And, I bet that pretty much everyone who knows has either playing it or has heard of it at some point, because it's one of those universal experiences. But if you look at the number of games that occupy the same space as Candy Crush, you'll be hard pressed to find one that's more than that's still popular, that's more than a few months old. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Clash of Clans. There's an awful lot of strategy games and I guess what you call them mid-core games for the iPad, and you know, Clash of Clans, Heyday, and so forth are outliers as far as their longevity is concerned. Most of them seem to be churning every 2-3 months or so.
Yeah, and that's interesting about how these games can generally not last that long. I think another issue with that is the problem with cloning of a lot of mobile games. We've seen this not only with the mobile market, but with social games, that how when one game is popular, you're going to see 5 to 10 other developers make a very similar game, either same exact mechanics, or maybe a female instead of a male character, and stuff
precisely
like that.
Precisely the same. And to be clear, when I say these games have a very limited lifespan, I don't mean that they necessarily close down after a few months, but basically after a while they probably got all the subscribers they're ever going to have, and people are going to continue playing those games and enjoying those games, and it's then up to the engagement mechanics in the games to try and keep those players in and paying, but the chances are they're probably not attracting new players anywhere near the level they were when they were launched.
Especially as you said, that a game only remains on like the front page of the App Store for maybe 2 to 3 days before it gets pushed down and off.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So to wrap things up, I want to talk briefly about the turn-based strategy genre, because I've had some questions I've been meaning to ask someone. I know that you've worked on it and you're a fan of it.
Sure.
So my first question to you, Ian, is with turn-based strategy, the genre itself, it's a very inclusive genre in the sense that every game essentially has its own unique systems and rule structure. And it's one of the few genres where you can't really translate your skills from one game to another. When I play an action game, if I'm good at a game like Devil May Cry, I can sort of handle the same exact way in a game like Ninja Gaiden or God of War, whatever. But when I play a turn-based strategy game, just because I understand the rules of Civ 5 doesn't mean that Europa Universal is going to come, you know, very easily to me.
I disagree slightly there. So it's not the same skills that you're transferring. Mm-hmm. So when you're good at action games or driving games or shooting games, whatever, obviously if you're a pro Counter-Strike player, you can drop into any first-person shooter and you'll probably do pretty well. Same as if you're super at Gran Turismo or whatever, you can start playing Need for Speed or whatever, and you'll probably do pretty well there too. Mm-hmm. With turn-based strategy games, where the skill isn't about twitch or about reactions or about super controlled input. It's about understanding mechanics. Yeah. It's about understanding how the game works and grokking it to the most basic level, what you have to do to win. And that's the skill that carries across. Okay. So, but you're correct when you say that if you understand the rules for Civ 5, you don't necessarily understand the rules for Europa Universalis or Crusader Kings 2 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what you will find is that if you're the kind of person who's good at quickly understanding rule sets and quickly understanding how mechanics work, then that is a skill that does carry across. So you tend to find that people who are good at, I don't know, Age of Empires, for example, tend to also be good at Civ, because it's the same. Although the rules are different, although the systems are different, if you're the kind of person who can see through the UI and see through the mechanics and get to the point where you're able to deconstruct things very quickly and figure out the fastest and easiest path to victory, that's a skill that carries across in whatever game you're playing.
Yep, and that is a great point. Once you start understanding, as you say, if you can start breaking things down, start seeing how X interacts with Y and causes Z, that is universal, and you can start basically create these patterns and create these schemas in your head as to how the game will play and the best ways to get around the rule set.
For sure.
Now, another question I have for you, as someone who's both designing a turn-based strategy and has played them, in your opinion, what constitutes a good turn-based strategy system? Because as we just said, the rules of these games are pretty inclusive, as they each feature different mechanics and different systems. So in your opinion, what do you consider is a good turn-based strategy game, and what do you consider is a poorly designed one, or not as good?
So first of all, what constitutes a good game is it depends on the kind of game. In my opinion, I feel that the turn-based strategy game should the turn-based element should be key to the experience. If it's something that could just as easily be a real-time strategy game, but you've made it turn-based because, then that, in my opinion, is how you make a bad turn-based strategy game. Turn-based element has to be intrinsic to the design, and the design has to be informed by that point. So, for example, if you just put in an I go, you go mechanic into, for example, Command and Conquer, that would be a bad turn-based strategy game because there's no reason to make it like that, and the game isn't advanced by that. So the thing about turn-based strategy is that players have the chance to have time to sit and make their choices. I mean, sometimes that time can be constrained. There might be a timer ticking down, or there might be some kind of other resource that's being used up while they're waiting. But players, you have to assume that given the opportunity to look at the whole board, understand exactly what's going on with the pieces they control and what's going on with the information they have from their player, from the other player, or the AI or whatever, that they're going to make the best decision. So as a designer, the challenge for making a turn-based strategy game isn't to overwhelm with choice as it often is in real-time strategy games, where the player has to prioritize whether he's reacting to something over here or something over there or whatever. In turn-based strategy games, the player doesn't have that pressure, so you have to assume he's always going to make the best decision. So what you're doing is you're testing his decision making rather than his skill at prioritizing or his skill at micromanaging. So you're saying to the player, here are the choices available to you. Which of these is the best one? And that's the skill you're testing with the turn-based strategy.
Yep, and that is a good point about the twitch or the APM. When you see in a traditional real-time strategy game, like one of the major elements of playing StarCraft II, for instance, is less about trying to figure out your best choice, but figuring out how to make my choice quicker than my opponent.
Absolutely.
And that is one of the things that has really driven me out of traditional real-time strategy play, because I found that my hands are just too freaking slow to get up to like 60, 70 APM. I like to play a game where I can sit there and go, okay, this is option A, this is option B. What will help me out the most here? What will help me out the least? And how will this play out over the next 5, 10 turns?
Sure.
Now, going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding if a real-time strategy game is essentially square peg into a round hole into a turn base and that it doesn't work for you, what are your thoughts on games that have basically plausible real-time? Any game like, I'm trying to think a few off my head, like Fallout Tactics or Jagged Alliance, do you consider those games to be examples of a turn-based strategy game, or are they more real-time sort of squeeze into a turn-based role?
No, I think those are definitely real-time games, because again, what they're testing is your ability to micromanage and your ability to react to different situations as they arise. The fact that it also gives the opportunity to sort of zoom out and get an overall look at what's going on, to me, that's more of a difficulty mechanic than anything else. It gives you a chance to understand more of what's going on more easily than the and in those games you mentioned, having that option to pause the action and scroll out and have a look around you is pretty vital, because otherwise there's just so much going on that even a skilled player would quickly become overcome. So once you scale up beyond a certain level, once you scale up beyond, say, the level of, say, the average StarCraft map, as you mentioned, then you need to have that ability, because otherwise even the best player wouldn't be able to keep up with what's happening. So it does, the fact that you have the pausable real time doesn't really make it a turn-based game in most examples.
Okay. Now, another element of a turn-based strategy game compared to other genres is the amount of time to play, or what would be considered the normal duration of a game. As you
Sure.
mentioned a few minutes ago, because they are turn-based, you have pretty much all the time in the world to play them.
Sure.
In your opinion, do you like strategy games, or let me rephrase that, do you specifically like turn-based strategy games that they have hours upon hours of play them? Like there's, of course, the famous Civilization quote, one more turn. Or do you
Sure.
like a turn-based strategy game that you could play through maybe in an afternoon or over a day?
Again, I like both. I mean, the game I'm making is designed, because it's a mobile game, it's designed for a mobile session. So we're trying to give people meaningful in-game goals they can achieve in 5 to 10 minutes. So you can pick up your iPad, you can turn it on, launch your app, And 5 to 10 minutes later, you can have achieved something in the game, which means you can then shut the game off and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing at your lunch break. You're playing between commercial breaks on the TV. Mm-hmm. You're generally not sitting down with your iPad for hours at a time, mm-hmm. in the same way you are for a PC game.
Yeah.
Having said that, I'm also playing a Civilization 5 game through PitBoss, mm-hmm. With some friends of mine, and it's, obviously we're taking our turns. It's more like a play-by-mail game,
mm-hmm.
and we've been playing it now for about 6 weeks, and we're about 40 turns in. So there's definitely space for both of those in the market, and with any particular player as well. I mean, XCOM is a good example of a game. You can sit down and play it for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. You can play one mission.
Yeah.
You can do an all-nighter and play the whole game in, you know, a couple of nights if you want to do that.
Yeah. Now, going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago regarding how when you're trying to translate between one strategy game and the other, part of that is understanding how rules break down, how mechanics work. And an important element of that is good UI design. Now, we mentioned this way back at the beginning of the cast, how when you're working on a mobile game, you have to be very aware of the touch UI and how buttons and the interface is built.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to a turn-based strategy game, building off of that, what are some elements that you think make a good UI for a strategy game? And what would be something that would not work for a turn-based strategy?
Okay, so UI design has a few general fundamental principles, which are the same regardless of what kind of game you're making, whether you're making a first-person shooter or making a strategy game or whatever. And the first thing is not to overwhelm the player with choice, not to overwhelm the player with information he doesn't need. So the player should always have access to the things that he needs to see,
mm-hmm.
to play the game, to do the action he's doing. And sometimes this can be context-sensitive menu, sometimes it can be just general information that's always available, like, you know, your points, what you need to do to win the game, how close you are to winning the game is a classic example of, you know, information that needs to be always available no matter where you are.
Mm-hmm.
How much currency you have in the game, how whether you're taking damage from something, all this stuff has to be indicated to you all the time. It can't be something that's optional. But there's a lot of obviously information in any game that isn't as important to the player, that the player might want to check out, but doesn't necessarily want to have it available all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's tempting as a designer to go, okay, well, we'll just show him everything and let him make the choice he wants to do, what actually that tends to do is it tends to push the important information off the screen or diminish its importance or diminish its focus.
Yeah.
So if the player has 50 numbers to look at and there's one that's really important, then there's nothing, it's hard to bring his attention to that one number. Whereas if he's got one number visible on the screen and 49 of them are hidden in separate menus or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then it's very clear to the player what he should be looking at. So that's kind of a fundamental issue in UI design. And honestly, UI design is a thing I didn't really know much about until I started working at Akoni,
mm-hmm.
which is where we're making the first-person shooter game. And we were in Germany, we're in the south of Germany in the Black Forest. And we had terrible trouble trying to hire and keep UI designers. It was an absolute nightmare. I think there must be some kind of nano plague which is killing them all off or something, because we never had one for more than like 3 or 4 months, and they get headhunted and poached by other companies. So more by accident than anything else, I ended up having to pretty much learn how to do UI design from the ground up. And as somebody who doesn't have a graphic design background and doesn't have a web design background or any kind of graphics background, this was kind of interesting to me to look at it from a purely mechanical point of view. So obviously, I'm not looking at what color things should be, whether we should use drop shadows or not use drop shadows, or whether we should have rounded edges on the icons or whatever. What I'm looking at is purely mechanical stuff, like What's the information the player needs to have access to right now? How do we make sure that he has that information as clearly and as unambiguously as possible? How do we make sure that when something is happening that he needs to talk about, that he needs to be aware of, we bring his attention to that element as fast as possible?
Mm-hmm.
And that's true no matter what kind of genre of game you're making, whether you're making a strategy game, whether you're making a first-person shooter, whether you're making a driving game, whatever you're doing, you should always be aware of, at any point in the game, what's the most important thing? What do you want the player to be looking at? What information do you want to give the player at this point? And how do you make sure that that is the most, the thing that has the most focus on the screen at any one time?
Yeah.
And then you have to balance that, of course, by not making it too hard to find the other information that might be required. So, you know, hiding things three layers deep in menus is obviously a bad idea as well, but it's a balancing act.
Yep, and that was my next point as well, because I've seen strategy games that go for a very minimalistic UI, but then you're going through 10 different menus, 5 different screens and drop downs to figure out, you know, what my tax rate is or how much culture I'm producing. And that
so that yep. sorry
Oh, no, go ahead. I was done.
So that's largely, that's not so much a UI design decision. I mean, it's where it's the element where that's where the game, the game design informs the UI design. How much information do you need? So in some games, like, I mean, in let's use Civ as an example, because I guess most people listening to this podcast have probably at least played one iteration of Civ at some point.
Yeah.
So if you look at Civ, especially the latest one, the actual UI on the main HUD, the main head-up display, when you're in your map and you're scrolling around, you can see your units and your cities and so forth, is relatively lightweight. There's not an awful lot of information there. In the most cases. And then, of course, as you'll know, if you played at any level at all, you can drill down very very detailed. You can open your city, you can specify exactly what your citizens in each city are doing, and you can optimize things for like gold or production or food or whatever it is you want to do. And there's an awful lot of fine tuning you can do under the hood to advance whatever victory condition you're going for. But for the player who isn't ready for that yet, or who isn't interested in that yet, then all of that is largely invisible, which is, to me, that's a good balance. So you see things like, Civ is an example of a game that has a good balance between complexity and simplicity, because you can play it both ways. You can either play it super, super complex, or you can play it super simple. And obviously, the more involved you get, generally speaking, the better you'll do, but you don't have to be involved to win. When you look at things like some of the more arcane Forex games, for example, you have all these different options. I've been playing Kerbal Space Program, for example. That's a game that has a very, very arcane UI.
Oh yeah.
there's an awful lot of information that's given to the player, and the player really has no way of evaluating the data that's given to him. There's nothing really. It's very hard, especially as a new player, to weigh up the advantages of one choice over a different choice. So in this case, although it's to a seasoned player, to a veteran player, that choice is a good thing, and it lets you make better decisions. To begin with, it actually makes you make worse decisions, because you have so many things to choose from. It's difficult to decide. It's difficult to evaluate the choices that you're being offered. So you end up pretty much making them at random.
Yeah,
and that's certainly my experience anyway. I just clicked on things that looked cool, and then found out my rocket wouldn't even take off.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah, Kerbal Space Program is a great example of the problem with too much freedom and choice. When you give the player 100 different options and they don't even know, option one from option two, there's no sense of a learning curve, because you don't know what you're doing. You're just putting stuff together, and if it works, great, but I don't know what I did to make it work. And if it doesn't work, same thing. I don't know what I did to not make it work. So you're just, going around circles of just pure dumb luck.
Exactly. So most successful games that do have that level of complexity, they phase it in sequentially. So they don't give you the choices until you've learned how to make those choices. They start you off with some basics. If I was designing Kerbal Space Program, I'd say, okay, here's a rocket. Put these two parts together and understand how this works. Now, here's two different things. Understand how they're different. Understand what the choice between them is, what trade-off you're making by choosing one over choosing the other one, and then go that way. But obviously, that's not a decision they've made at the moment. They've given you access to everything and thrown you in the deep end, some players love that. Some players love that, but it's it certainly makes it much less approachable for newer players, or for players who aren't used to that level of complexity.
Yep, definitely. And I do know that they have been working on like a career mode or a science progression mode that limits yourself from the get-go, and then you're sort of working and building right up to those choices, which I think is good. And I think that's probably when I will try to jump back into Kerbal, when they've limited me down to, hey, I only have one rocket choice, let me play around with that before you give me 50, 60 other parts and experiment with those. All right. I know it is 6 my time, 12 your time. I think I got one more question, if you have time for it.
Yeah, that's fine.
And this is sort of what we were just talking about in terms of easing the player into understanding it, and that is tutorial design. This is one of the hardest parts when it comes to a strategy game, is developing a good tutorial. Something that not only teaches the player the mechanics, but as you said, sort of teach them to understand and make those choices. So,
absolutely.
In your opinion, I guess, what elements do you think make up good tutorial design, and can you think of any games that are examples of that?
Okay, well, as it happens, actually, we've just finished doing the tutorial level for the game I'm working on, for Tactical Heroes, and we call it the onboarding, it's the same kind of thing. And because it's a mobile game, we're very aware that the player probably isn't going to be sitting down and opening our game and playing it for a long time at a stretch. So we tried to keep the tutorial experience to be quite tight, quite limited, about 10 to 12 minutes, so the player can get through that whole thing and understand the basic concepts of the game in that time frame. So that's a specific constraint that we had. And in general, that's a good guideline to work from for tutorials. If you spend too long teaching the player how to use the game, then a lot of players will become frustrated by that. They'll think, well, okay, why am I still learning the game? Why can't I just jump in and play the game? So the answer to that is either to make the tutorial invisible to the player, where it's not really presented as a tutorial at all. The player is just unlocking items or unlocking abilities and having them explained to them sequentially as he gains them. Example of that would be something like Diablo 3, for example, where you start off, or most MMOs, you start off with a stick and an attack or a zap spell or something, and then when you get to level 2, you get 2 zap spells, or you get a better stick, and the game teaches you by doing, but you start off with very, very limited palette of resources of abilities to work from. Mm-hmm. The other thing is to break down the tutorial experience, because it's not usually necessary to teach the player how to use every single thing right at the beginning. And obviously, and that can have the opposite effect anyway. It can overwhelm the player if he thinks that, okay, well, you're giving the player all this stuff, and you're teaching how to use the stuff, and a lot of it's not going to be things he's going to even be interested in until he's been playing for an hour or 2 hours,
like
3 hours, whatever.
Kerbal Space Program example of giving
him exactly. So precisely. So teach him how the basic principles of the game work, how to move, how to shoot, how to access the different UI screens or whatever, and how the different options in the game work, at a fundamental level, at a basic level, sort of a general overview. So here's where you go to see how many points you've got, here's where you go to access your vehicle factory, here's where you go to do science. And then as the player advances in the game, have the tutorial pop up again with the new things. Okay, so now you've got the point where you can do this in the game, so this is how that works. And that way the player doesn't have to sit through like an hour long tutorial. They sit through a 20 minute tutorial or 10 minute tutorial, and then they get a bunch of like 2 minute tutorials later on.
Yeah, I think that also stems into the popularity of Let's Plays as tutorials. Because when you're watching a Let's Play video, the person basically goes through how you would generally play the game. So he's
Absolutely.
Not going to talk about what you're doing in hour 15. He's going to start with, okay, I'm building this city up, I'm checking my culture, because that's what you need to do at this level. And then when something important comes up, then they focus on that new mechanic or that new system.
Yeah.
And as you said, when you start doing like those really big tutorials, either A, you're going to bore the player to death before he or she gets through the whole thing, or you're basically just dumping a bunch of information on the player that they're not going to be able to retain all that, because they don't know what all the stuff's doing. Like, if you're trying to teach the player culture or adjusting tax rates before building a city, they're not going to know how all these elements are in relation to each other.
Sure.
Okay. I think that does it for my question, at least for now. I know that you have to get going. Before we end things, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to end with?
I'd like to encourage all your readers to go and check out our app page. It's tacticalheroes.com, and look at the progress we're making on our game. It'll be out for a limited release at the end of February, beginning of March time. And we're looking for a global release about a month or so after that. We're very excited by it. It's going to be our first game from this studio in Madrid. Okay. And we're hoping that it's a big enough success that we can build on it and produce another one afterwards.
Is the game going to be aimed solely for the iPad market, or are you also going to bring it to the PC at some point?
We're making it purely for iOS at the moment, and potentially there's an option we might compile it for Android as well in the future, but right now we're developing purely for the iPad.
Awesome. All right. So I think with that, we can wrap things up for this week's cast. So Ian, it was great meeting with you, and I hope we can talk again later on.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it immensely.
All right. And as always, for those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, either as a writer for a guest piece or for being a guest on the future podcast, you can email me under Submissions Wanted on the front page. That will take you to the guidelines as well as my contact link. So with that said, have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.